Dr. Sane and his work, but let me just give him a quick introduction. Dr. Sane is a graduate of the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, where he graduated in 1982, and he's a board certified in homeopathy in 1988 by the Homeopathic Academy of Naturopathic Physicians. He's also a world-renowned lecturer, educator, and practitioner, and is really one of the guiding lights for real Hahnemannian homeopathy. And I could go on and on and tell you all kinds of wonderful things about Dr. Sane, but I think the best testimonial that I could give is that I am a person who travels quite a bit all over the world for homeopathy. And more than any other person, I frequently come into contact with patients, former patients of Dr. Sane, who at one time had critically, physically debilitating chronic degenerative type conditions who are now completely cured. And I've, in my travels, probably come across, I would say, 5 or 6 or 7 people who were either bedridden or in wheelchairs who Dr. Sane was able to successfully treat and cure with homeopathy. And to me, that's the most profound and powerful testimony that we have. Dr. Sane really is someone who has mastered homeopathy. He's a true master who can not only apply it in his own practice, but has the unique gift of being able to educate others and to create proficient homeopaths throughout the world. So thank you so much for joining us on this call. Let me just mention quickly, if you want to get more information about Dr. Sane or his work, you can visit his website, which is www.homeopathy.ca. And if you want the phone number at his office, it's 514-279-0111. So it's www.homeopathy.ca, or the office number is 514-279-0111. When you go to his site, you'll notice that he has an excellent 500-hour video training course, which I have I've actually purchased myself and is absolutely fantastic. It's a comprehensive training in real Hahnemannian homeopathy. So you might want to check that out when you do visit his site. Andre, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Kim.
Okay, good. So, Andre, the first thing, I know that you're a real scholar of the history of homeopathy, and also this is a passion of mine, the history of homeopathy and history in general, and I know we've talked about this in the past, and I thought perhaps you could give us a sense of, because I know you're so passionate about the history of homeopathy, what it is that the history of homeopathy can teach us about homeopathy, why it's important, why it's relevant, and how it what it has to tell us for what's going on in homeopathy today.
Well, homeopathy has a history of great ups and great downs. And if you don't know your history, you're bound to go down. That's the main lesson. So it's very important to understand the history first, to know what is homeopathy, how it's well practiced, and how do you know how it's well practiced by the results? So who got the best results? How they obtain it? And what has been the mistake that were done in the past? So we don't need to repeat them today.
Andre, where did you primarily learn your vast knowledge of the history of homeopathy? Did you take a course? Did you study from the journal? How did you acquire this knowledge?
Through reading the journal. The journal are a testimony of the past, so what was happening at the time has been printed in the Homeopathic Journal. Unfortunately, the books on history, either written by people favorable to homeopathy or just allopaths that wrote on medical history or medical historians with a bias towards allopathy, you cannot really find the real history of homeopathy in those books. You have to go and read the journal, and that's where I discovered the real history of homeopathy. I mean, when I say the real history, it means some of the most essential aspect of the history of homeopathy, which you will not find in many book on the history of homeopathy.
So would you include Bradford's works in that as well, as not being necessarily as useful as going to the primary sources and the journals? And
well, Bradford, for instance, he wrote about, let's say, the life and letters of Hahnemann, so that's very essential. But it tells you about one person. If he doesn't go beyond them, then he has the book The Pioneer, which is mostly the biography of the practitioner, early practitioner before 1835. So anybody after 1835 will not be found in the pioneers. Bradford has a book on the logic of figures, which is, this is a bit more important book in terms of, these are statistics on, in other words, results obtained by homeopaths compared to allopaths in different epidemics. And he's got a book on the history of the Homeopathic Medical College of Pennsylvania or the Hahnemann Medical College. And, but these are facts, certain factual, like, data, you could say. But in terms of who practiced homeopathy well, what kind of success they obtained, how did they learn it, you will not find in any of the books, whether it's King or Bradford or Coulter.
So, Andre, you know, I've read in different places different opinions about what caused the eventual decline of homeopathy at the, you know, the turn of the 20th century. And, you know, some people blame it on the Flexner Report. And then I even read an article in American Homeopath about the famous speech that Carol Dunham gave inviting the allopaths into the AIH and how that basically caused homeopathy to lose its identity. I'm curious, what is your feeling was the primary cause of the, or multiple causes of the decline of homeopathy?
Well, there's many factors there. There are factors from the outside and factor from within the profession. From the outside, of course, there was a strong opposition to homeopathy from the allopaths. And the 19th century saw the organization of the allopaths into becoming, in developing association and so on. And one of their first resolution in many of these associations, like, for instance, the AMA, was to put an end to homeopathy. So, definitively, there was a strong opposition to homeopathy. In terms of, from within, homeopathy, you have to understand that homeopathy was not very popular until there was epidemics. So if we just go back in time a bit, if we look at the development of homeopathy, we start with Hahnemann. He was born in 1755, graduated from medical school at 24 in 79. Around 1784, he was treating his child that was very sick, and he says, there's more chance that I'm going to kill my child by using the heroic method of medicine that exists right now. And he says, God must have created something better than that to treat the human beings. And he says, so he abandoned basically the practice of medicine and he went into translating. You know, he was very, very capable in language. He knew 11 languages, or he learned 11 languages. So he was very skilled in language, so he was able to read and all the old medical texts. He had access, actually, as a medical student and also as a young graduate, to some of the best library in Europe. And one library was the he cataloged a library of alchemists. And so he was aware of a lot of history of medicine, and the principle of similia was throughout the history of medicine. So in 1790, when he translated the Collins, he came to the paragraph on the pyrrhovium bark, that it's a tonic and a bitter to the stomach, and he didn't buy this because there's substances that are more bitter and more tonic to the stomach and have no relationship with malaria or intermittent fever. It happens that Hahnemann had malaria when he was a medical student. It happens that he was treated successfully with pyrrhovium bark, which is contains quinine. And E was, as a physician, E had used pyrimobox successfully in people with intermittent fever in certain type of patient. And he also knew that if you gave too much of the pyrimobox, it would create chills and fever similar to malaria. And he was aware of the work of Van Almon, a physiologist from Switzerland, who had said, if you want to know the true property of medicine, you have to experiment them in healthy people. So at that moment, when he was translating Collins, he decided to do the experiment. So he went and bought 8 drams of pyrimobox tincture, and he took 2 drams, and he repeated the experiment 4 times, and he recorded the symptom, and he realized that the symptoms that are produced by the intoxication of pyrimobox was reproducible 4 times, and it was very similar to the symptom that he had when he had intermittent fever. So from there, you know, it went like a click, and he started to experiment more. He proved more medicine, and 6 years later, 1796, he announced his discovery. He said, here is a very important principle of medicine. It's an old principle, and now it's old. People had, you can find it in antiquity, in ancient medicine. People talk about it. Nobody has developed a system from it, but here it is. It is a therapeutic rules, you could say. Then, 9 years later, in 1805, he writes an article called The Medicine of Experience. He developed further the phenomena of the principle of similarity. 1810, he writes his first edition of the Argonaut. And it happened at that time that Napoleon used the city where he was living, which was Torgau in Germany, as his headquarters. So he had to move out. And fortunately, he moved to Leipzig, which had the university there. And he decided to teach at Leipzig. And after he wrote his thesis and passed his thesis to be a professor, he started to teach, but he didn't have any, actually adopted homeopathy. So you could say that even though he had announced the principle of stimulation in 1796, wrote a major article in Medicine of Experience in 1805, and the Argonaut in 1810, he was still the only homeopath in the world, except for people that had used belladonna and scarlet fever, but not as a system, just for scarlet fever. There was a lot of allopath that had used it and reported successful good result with belladonna to prevent or treat people with scarlet fever, which Hahnemann had recommended. So, actually, when he was teaching at the University of Leipzig, people didn't take him seriously because he was so talking so much against allopathy that people made fun of him. However, Napoleon loses war, his army retreats, and they lose, the army of Napoleon is affected by a typhus to such a degree that Napoleon lost about one-third of his army to typhus, which is considerable. Now, he had about 600,000 soldiers retreating from Russia, and 200,000 of them died on the way back from typhus. He spread typhus throughout Germany in the population, and Hahnemann had the chance there to treat typhus in a hospital. He treated 183 patients with typhus in a hospital, and usually a person that was hospitalized was a person usually that was sicker than average. And when you consider that the death rate of typhus is 20 to 70% in older people and 20% in young people, so you could say maybe an average of 30 or 40%. Out of 183 patients, Hahnemann lost none. Wow, that made a sensation. Not among the allopaths as a rule, but among some recent graduates from the Leipzig University that knew Hahnemann, and that was Staff, and he brought his colleague Gross with him, and they were the first two students. So here you had first two students in 1813 only. Then homeopathy became a bit more known through the student. There was the first journal in 1822. And when Hahnemann, there was a major article that was published in 1830 about whether homeopaths should use allopathy. And Hahnemann answered the article and said, no, it should not be mixed. They're incompatible. But he asked my disciple to write answers to the journal about this. There was about eight of his disciples that wrote back, and all eight agree, not with Hahnemann, but with the other author, that yes, it should be mixed with allopathy. So just to tell you that even the first disciple of Hahnemann were not pure homeopaths. And it's just to tell you how difficult it is to learn homeopathy, even for the earlier student that had, the only literature they had was the writing of Hahnemann. In any case, so 1830 is the major epidemic of cholera affects Europe, and eventually it will affect America in 1832. And that's where homeopaths got great results, because the death rate, the average death rate from cholera was 55% about, sometimes it was 70%. And the homeopath usually kept the death rate below 6%, oftentimes with 3%, and then eventually to 1 and 0%. But it was dramatically less as compared to the allopath, from 55 to 6% is dramatic difference. And just to give you an example how homeopathy became popular, take a city like Cincinnati during the cholera epidemic of 1849. There were two good homeopaths, Herman and Pulte. They were graduates from the Allentown Academy, and they treated, if I recall, something about 3,000 patients with a death rate of 3%. That was extraordinary, because the newspaper in Cincinnati would print every day during the time of the epidemic the death and which doctor were treating them. And it happens that the allopath lost 55% of their case. So imagine if you were a citizen of Cincinnati at that time, and you knew if you go to an allopath, you had 55% chance of dying if you had cholera or a member of your family had cholera. But if you went to the homeopath, you had a 3% chance of dying. So the decision was very clear and easy which doctor you choose. And the decision also was easy after the epidemic. Nowadays, the allopaths with the heroic method of bleeding and using mercury and cauterization and purging and vomiting and so on was not very popular. So they lost a lot of popularity. First, they were not popular to start with, no, because it was a torturing type of medicine, but they lost a lot of popularity and standing in face of the homeopath. So the homeopath became very, very popular to the point that they made much more money than the allopath. They were much more popular in the society than the homeopath. The higher class of society, especially in cities like New York, Boston, Philadelphia, they went towards homeopathy as compared to the learned person left behind allopathy. So they lost a lot of standing. So the war started. That's when the war started between the profession, when the allopaths lost money and their standing. Now, a lot of people want to be called homeopaths now, so a lot of people join. And they, it diluted the quality of the practice by having that affluence of less qualified practitioner joining the profession. Eventually, they started schools, they wrote books, and all of this was of a low quality. So eventually, homeopathy came to a point where it was very popular. There was a lot of practitioners calling themselves homeopaths, but in fact, there was a minority that knew how to practice well and get good results. And what you mentioned before about the speech of Carol Dunham in 1870, it's just one more thing that you could say broke the camel's back. It's when the American Institute eventually voted a resolution to accept anybody as member of the American Institute, even though they know nothing about homeopathy. So when that resolution passed, Lippe had mentioned before, he says, if that resolution passed, we will lose all our institution. Everything will go. So we have to preserve Puro Miate, and they started the IHA at that time, and which actually was probably the institution that did the best to preserve Omiati until today. The IHA existed and they met until 1959. So from 1880 to 1959 they met, and it really gave a second breath to homeopathy. So just if we look at this overall picture, you see that homeopathy was not very popular when Ahnemann was teaching it or publishing his book until there was the first epidemic of typhus. He had his first student. Then the homeopaths that were practicing didn't do great, and they didn't practice well as a rule. And but when there were more epidemics that came, like cholera and so on, it became more and more and more popular. A lot of people joined, and the quality was diluted. Eventually, it had to collapse. At the same time that homeopathy became weak, the allopath became strong with the development of bacteriology, of the emphasis on they went away from aortic medicine. Now they stopped bleeding patients. They stopped giving mercury to every patient. They stopped doing all their torturing. So they went to smaller dose, single remedy. They imitate a lot the homeopath. So at the same time as the allopath got their act a bit better, the homeopath got weak. And even before the Flexner report, like in 1900, there was, if I recall, 22 schools of homeopathy in the United States. And by 1904, 4 years later, there was four less. And by 1908, there were four less again. And by the time the Flexner report came out, the homeopaths had already lost probably half of their school by that time, by 1910. And by 1922, there was two schools left, and then the last one was the Ahnemann College in the 50s that closed, or the 40s, I can't recall now. But the decline of homeopathy started a long time ago when people adopted homeopathy without proper learning it properly. So, and that's the same, the situation is exactly the same today. In the 70s, there was more interest in the general population in Europe and in America towards alternative medicine. In the 80s, there was a big explosion of interest towards alternative medicine, including homeopathy, and it continued in the 90s, but a lot of people took up homeopathy, a lot of people studied homeopathy, but few did it very well. The result didn't come. People became disillusioned, both the patient and practitioner, and homeopathy is again on the decline today.
You know, Andre, I want to confirm that my impression is very much the same, because I travel around a lot and go to a lot of different schools and meet with a lot of different people, and my impression is that homeopathy is very much stagnant or even declining, and when I meet students at different schools, they oftentimes seem very confused because there are so many different ideas that are circulating in homeopathy now, right now, and a lot of them contradict each other, and so I think this creates a lot of confusion in the community. My question to you is, what do you think we can do at this point to help homeopathy really take its rightful place in the healthcare, delivery of healthcare? Because it's, you know, we know it's such an important and such a critical medicine. What can we do at this point to really create a resurgence of interest in homeopathy? And also, if you could comment, I know you've been working to try to reestablish the IHA, the International Hahnemannian Association. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about how that's going and what role that might have to play with the reestablishment of real homeopathy. I don't mean to put you on the spot, and I hope you don't tell me we have to have an epidemic to get homeopathy to be successful again.
No.
Okay.
I mean, from my perspective, the problem is the same as 1830 when Hahnemann asked the homeopaths to meet him in Curtin. He says, I want to separate the goat from the sheep. In that way, the people that have learned homeopathy well and practice it well, and the other ones that just profess to do homeopathy but have not learned it well, and have a half foot in allopathy. And when Hahnemann died in 1843, Benninghausen wrote an article, and in it he says, the greatest monument we can have for Hahnemann is not to build a statue and so on, but it's actually to practice homeopathy well and publish our observation, our provings, our cure case. And he says, now is the time to separate the grain from the shaft. And in other ways, the people that practice well, let's get together and let's show how this can be done. And actually in 1844, the American Institute of Homeopathy was created, and the two reasons to develop the American Institute was, one is to develop a Mathematica that is pure and exclude from it symptoms that have been introduced in the later years that are not pure. In other words, are not from a sure source. And the second reason was to prevent a physician to practice homeopathy that have not studied it in a skillful manner. So you see that the emphasis there is to make sure that the mathematical we use is pure, and second, to prevent physicians that say they practice homeopathy that have not studied it in a skillful manner. Then when Benninghausen died in 1864, Lippe said, now it is the time to separate the dross from the metal. So everyone uses a different expression, but it's the same meaning. In other words, we have the people that practice pure homeopathy, let's get together again and show how it should be done. And this did not happen until 1880 when they started the IHA. And just to give you an idea, when they started the IHA in 1880, there was no school that were teaching the Organon. But when in 5 years after they started the IHA, by 85 about, all school in America were using the Organon to teach the Organon. And if you look in journal, you'll notice that in 1880 there was very poor homeopathy in the homeopathic journal in the United States. But like you'll see a lot of combination, a lot of multiple prescription, low potency, pathological prescribing. But if you look like 5, 8, 9 years later, you barely see any of these prescriptions anymore. In that way, the IHA had raised the standard. And a lot of people say they learn homeopathy by reading the writing of the Hahnemannians. That would be the case of Yingling. Yingling said, now when he graduated, he didn't know how to practice homeopathy, but he learned how to practice homeopathy by reading the physician, the homeopathic physician, and which was the official organ of the IHA. So, I think the idea to reactivate the IHA, the reason to reactivate the IHA are the same reason as why it was founded to start with, and the same reason that Hahnemann says we need to separate the gold from the sheep, and Benninghausen and Lippe said the same thing, is the people that practice well should get together, have meetings, publish literature, and show how homeopathy should be done. And that's what we're trying to do right now, is to reactivate the IHA.
And how is that going, Andre? Is it moving along, or any time schedules, or?
Probably you will find out by 2006 about the IHA.
Okay, great. Fantastic. Well, thank you. That was a wonderful answer. I thought perhaps we could go off the subject of history, and I could just ask you a question about the actual practice of homeopathy. And the question I wanted to ask you is something that relates to a very popular notion that exists in homeopathy today. There are some teachers out there who are basically advocating the idea that when you find the quote-unquote constitutional remedy or the chronic remedy, the one perfect similimum of, quote-unquote similimum of this particular patient, when you find that one remedy, that would be the remedy this person needs for the rest of their life, regardless of whether they get an acute, regardless of whether they get hit in the head, that this remedy will always have a positive effect and will always have a curative action regardless of their situation, because you found the one perfect remedy for the patient. I'm curious what you think about that, what your experience is, and if you could give us any insights as to this particular point of view.
First, I'd like to ask you a question about this. How popular is that notion?
Well, I think there are certain teachers who advocate it explicitly, Andre, and teach it as part of their curriculum. And then it's implicit with many other people in the community. I would say, though, it's a fairly significant percentage of the community who accepts or embraces this particular point of view. I would say probably 20-25% of the community.
That concept didn't exist. The concept of a constitutional remedy didn't start it until about 1884. That's the first time I can see a quote about it. And that's when Kant came into the profession. And as you know, Kant's Mathematica was often he stereotyped and personalized remedies. In other words, he would give almost give a personality to the remedy, and he kind of fixed an image of a team of which patient would what a remedy looks like when a patient needs it. Now, this is Kant was not taught in the Anomanian tradition. Now, this is not an Anomanian concept, and it's somewhat distorting the Mathematica. And from there, people develop supra-Kantian Mathematica, where it's even more refined and more going towards like very specific themes, and you have essence and portraits and so on. And it's a wrong concept, totally wrong concept. The law of similars requires that we individualize the case according to essentially to the symptoms that are present. And if you have an idea of what a remedy should look like, oftentimes you will never prescribe that remedy when it is indicated in the patient because of the characteristic symptom will point towards that remedy because it didn't fit your stereotype. In other words, you're misled by the essence that you have learned or the stereotype that you have learned. And it's very interesting because if you look at some cases, and I would point out to a very good article that was written by Anton Rohrer from Austria on this
subject. Could you spell the last name for us, Andre?
Rohrer, R-O-H-R-E-R.
Okay, thank you.
You can find it on the internet. It's a bit complicated because it's a German website, but it's all translated in English. They have a very good series of articles about the debate that went on in the last few years. You can have access to it through if you go to www.homeopathy.ca and you open the it will say links. If you open the place links and you'll see it will say pluralism debate. And you open that and you'll see an upper right, there will say table of content, and there will be a series of about 60 article or 80 article, I don't know, a lot of article. And then I think it's the fifth on the bottom, and it's called Certainty in Finding the Right Remedy. And he shows that great case had been cured by the use of three or four different remedy. While if that concept of that single remedy existed, that person will never have been cured probably. So the older practitioner, in other ways, like you look at Lippe or Bunninghausen, they didn't use a single remedy in the patient. They would change the remedy sometimes quite frequently, and the patient would, they had a very, very good track record. So a lot of the 20th century homeopaths have been misled by this trend that was started with Kant. What you need to understand is the following, is people will have constitutional symptoms. So the constitutional symptoms are like general symptoms, thirst, appetite, disposition, sensitivity, sleep, energy, and so on. And these constitutional symptoms will change in time, and they will change also during acute condition. And that was your thirst, your disposition, your sleep pattern, your appetite will change when you have an acute situation. And all prescription must consider always all the constitutional symptoms. So you always consider the disposition of the patient, whether it's acute or chronic. So all good homeopathic prescription is based on the constitutional symptom at all time. And as the constitutional symptoms change, the image picture change, and the remedy will change. So people that have developed that concept, it has nothing to do with Ahneman, it has nothing to do with the people that had successful practice, the most successful practice. It has nothing to do with this kind of practice. So unfortunately, a lot of people are misled, and they pay the price. I guess the patient paid the price.
Andre, this seems to be related to the whole issue of what symptoms are, like, you know, when somebody tells you all their information in a case, you know, some symptoms are going to be useful and you're going to use in your repertorization, and then there's other information which is really just kind of like noise and it's not useful. And one of the things that I oftentimes hear people confused about is like aspects of the person's personality that, you know, they like going to the movies or they like this. What value do those types of symptoms have? Like, or not even necessarily symptoms, but just the character, the qualities of the person. How can we use that for, or can we use that for finding the remedy?
They do have a place, but it's a more minor place. You know, the most important symptom in a case are the striking symptoms. And the likings of a person, if it's within normal limits, is not peculiar. So if somebody say they like to go to the movie or to read that kind of book, it's not peculiar. It's common. So you have to say, here we have a patient that has this kind of condition, let's say ulcerative colitis, and you say, what is most striking in this patient with ulcerative colitis, or this patient with schizophrenia? You say, what is most striking? That they like to go to the movie, it's not striking. That they like sugar, it's not striking. There's 50% or more percent of people that like sugar. But if a person would want to eat only sugar or mainly sugar, then that will be peculiar because the intensity makes it very strong, and then it becomes very unusual. How often you find somebody that wants to eat only sugar? So you always would ask, what is most striking about this patient? So a lot of these characteristics of the person might not be very important, actually. So the one that you just mentioned, like the normal characteristic of a person, oftentimes, as a rule, they're not important. Because it's part of the culture of the person, it's part of their education, it's part of the family learning and so on, so of the environment. So it's not necessarily particular to the individual.
Sometimes it's difficult to distinguish, though, what's learned or culturally induced and what's the symptoms of the mistreatment of the vital force. Do you have a way of determining that? Or?
No, it's not usually difficult because you can ask right away, how is your sibling about this?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or you learn about their culture. If somebody says, I like spicy food, and they're from a culture that eats spicy food, then you say, how is your liking of spicy food compared to your sibling? Oh, it's less. So then it's not peculiar.
Hmm.
So you always check with their sibling, their people in their environment. So if I have a child, I say, how are you compared to your friend in school for a certain aspect, you know? So then you compare. If so, oh, yeah, I like it more, I'm greater aversion to than my classmate, then you can see the intensity of the symptom. I don't think it's that difficult.
Okay, good. You know, I have a personal question I want to ask you, Andre, which is I know that Kent was primarily, in terms of his posology, he was mostly a fourth edition prescriber, you know, dry dose, weight, and C method. And I'm always curious by that since he did have access to the fifth edition of the Organon, and yet he didn't seem to take into consideration putting the remedies into solution or, you know, all of the things that were the split dose method of the fifth edition. I was curious if you knew why that was the case, and also I was curious as to what you were doing in your own practice. Are you using LMs? Are you using the fifth edition split dose? And why you've chosen to use that particular posology method?
I don't think that cats only use the dry dose. I think in acute he would use in water. Hmm. I'm quite sure about this.
Mm-hmm. Because he does write that water. It doesn't matter whether you put it in dry or liquid or.
Yeah, he would put in water when it was in acute cases. The other part of the question is, I do it myself. I don't use the LM. I use the scale from the lowest to the highest. Now, I have some MMMs that I use in the office. So I go from the lowest to the highest. The key here is to individualize the pathology to each patient at each visit. So you individualize the potency. You individualize the frequency of their repetition. You individualize the mode of administration. I would say over 50% of my patients, they take the remedy in water. And when I say in water, it means it's diluted in successive glass depending on the patient. Like today I talked to a patient, she's taking the remedy in 16 glass. She's taking she was taking a remedy in the 50 mg potency, and she was diluting it in 16 glass of 16 ounce. So this is all individualized according to the sensitivity of the patient, the type of condition they're having, how they're responding to the remedy, how much stress they have in their life, and so on. So I'm very supple about this, but the more you practice, the more experience you gather, the more you're able to individualize the pathology to obtain the best result, the optimal results. You don't want to under-prescribe, and you don't want to over-prescribe. You want to just have the optimal pathology.
Andre, I read an interview of yours on the Internet where I think you mentioned something to the effect that Hahnemann actually didn't really even have a lot of cases where he used the LM. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, Hahnemann developed the LM towards the beginning of 1841, and he died in July 43, so that's 2.5 years for the LMs. And the last few months of his life, he did not practice. I think the last patient he has as an entry is in May. So he didn't practice the last few months, and he didn't practice at all the last few months. And before he stopped practicing, he was seeing only a few patients that were very close to him. So he didn't have that much experience, and he didn't have many remedies in the LM. I think he had maybe, I have this all documented, but I don't have it in the tip of my finger. I have this very, very well documented. I have this from his case. So I have all the, his case of the, not all his case, but I have all his major case of the last 8 years of his practice. And he used maybe 10 remedies. He had about 10 remedies in the LM, and the highest, if I recall, the highest that you had in the LM was about a 20 LM for sulfur. But most of the remedy were not in LMs, and many remedy were not developed very high in the LM. So he didn't have that much experience, I would say, with it. And I would the results that you see in the books are not so spectacular as compared to the result previous to that 2.5 years.
Andre, just to go on another point here, one of the things that's quite popular, it's making a real resurgence in the homeopathic community, is the use of miasms. And there's even a new model now that utilizes 10 different miasms. And I know you have some strong opinions about miasms, and I'm under the impression that you actually don't really use them in your own practice. Could you comment on that or give us an idea of your understanding of miasms, and if you do use them, how you do use them?
Well, that's
I know. I got 5 minutes left, and I'm asking you a big question. But
is there 5 minutes left?
Well, I only have 5 minutes, and I have to open it up to the rest of the group. So.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a complex question, a very complicated thing. When Hahnemann developed when Hahnemann wrote about his discovery of the nature of chronic disease, he based it on his observation and the observation of other physician pathologists, and he used the pathology of his time. The concept of miasm was a common concept. Actually, the concept of miasm was used until, in medicine, was used until the turn of the 20th century. Towards the turn of the 19th to the 20th century was still in common use. So, Hahnemann developed the theory of chronic disease, and which was greatly based on syphilis. And from syphilis, he extrapolated the development of syphilis, he extrapolated to psychosis and sorrow. It's a very complicated subject. So I wrote about this. It's on the internet, so people can read about it. But just to give you a little summary here, I will say that Hahnemann made many, many mistakes in terms of facts. He quotes a lot of wrong facts, and he makes a lot of wrong assumptions. Once you know that these facts are wrong, this all discovery falls down. It's not valid anymore. It's useless. So, however, there's a few things that are useful in his old conception of the chronic disease. And some of the most important are that disease first, chronic disease are constitutional. That means that there is a predisposition to be sick, and we know today that it's hereditary rather than acquired, like Hahnemann suggests. It was acquired through, you know, by sorrow, by the itch. So this we know that the it is constitutional. Second is people will have early sign of that abnormal level of susceptibility, that constitutional weakness. And these early signs is what Hahnemann called latent sorrow. So this is very important. In other words, we can start to treat people before they develop advanced pathology by paying attention to those aspects of latent sorrow. This is extremely, extremely valuable. It's one of the most important and practical aspects of all is of his treatise on the nature of chronic disease. Third, we could say that is contrary to good health to suppress symptom or function of the organism, like a skin eruption or emotion or discharges. So Hahnemann pointed this out as not good. And now today we have confirmed, yes, expression, whether it's a physical expression or emotional expression, it should not be suppressed. Other aspects of that are important, that people can be not well since an infection long time ago. So, like you say, people will never be well since they had sorrow. They contracted sorrow. So sorrow is out, but we have this phenomenon of people never well since. Not only infection, but sometimes it will be after vaccination, never well since after being receiving certain drugs or certain emotional shock. So never well since a certain event, physical, emotional, chemical, infectious event, and that affects that susceptibility to be sick. Another very important positive aspect of the theory of chronic disease is that there's a direction in cure during treatment of a patient with chronic disease, and that certain symptoms will tend to disappear in a reverse order of appearance. And also, that there will be during the cure of people with chronic disease the return of old symptoms. And one of these old symptoms will be skin eruption. So that's very, very important to pay attention when we treat people with chronic disease. Another aspect that is very important, Hahnemann points out that when people have chronic disease and they have a symptom occurring on the skin, eczema, warts, he says there will be a group of remedy that will address these type of case, and these he call antipsoriatic. And in that way, to treat people with chronic disease, it is usually you will usually be successful by the remedy that Hahnemann points out to be antipsoriatic. While there was the other remedy, let's say like Nux Vomica, like Pulsatilla, and so on, that will be used also in people with chronic disease, but usually not as frequently you will use them to cure a patient with a chronic disease. You will have to use the other remedy that I call antipsoriatic. So there's many positive aspects in his treatise on chronic disease. However, the whole concept of miasm is based on wrong facts, and we don't need to repeat those mistakes, and it's totally non-academic. It's a lack of knowledge and reasoning to continue in the wrong direction. That Hahnemann made a mistake by an inch, and today now the degree of deviation is miles from the truth. So something is wrong with a profession that permits such a deviation without pointing out the mistake.
Andre, you said you have an extensive article on your website about this subject specifically?
Yeah, it is in an interview that was conducted about 4 or 5 years ago that was published in a German journal, but the English version of that interview is on the website. I can find it for you right now. Just hold on. It's on the website you said, homeopathy.ca, and you go in the section called articles, and in the section article, it's an interview called, it says, homeopathy is a natural science in its purest sense. And it's about the third or fourth question from the beginning, or maybe
okay.
The second question.
Fantastic. Andre, I'm going to unmute the lines and let some other people ask questions. Before I do that, though, I just wanted to let everybody know, I know Andre is aware of this as well, I just wanted to let everybody know who's not yet aware of this, that the great contemporary historian of homeopathy, Julian Winston, passed away last Saturday, and he was really one of the really claim holders for the history of homeopathy, along with people like Andre and Christopher Ellithorpe, who also passed away just recently. So I just wanted to let everybody know that, for those of you who were not yet aware that Julian did pass on. Also, I wanted to just remind you again that there are wonderful articles on Dr. Sain's website, which is www.homeopathy.ca, and he does have an excellent, I don't know if he's doing a lot of teaching right now, but he does have a very excellent 500-hour comprehensive course in homeopathy. You might want to check that out. I think it's available now on DVD and VHS as well. So let me go ahead now. Andre, thank you so much. It was a wonderful formal interview. Let me go ahead and unmute the lines and let some other people ask some questions. Somebody have a question they'd like to ask?
I have one. Hello, Andre, and thanks for spending time with us. Did I understand you correctly that you had the patient dilute their remedy through, was it 16 glasses of
yeah.
water?
Hey. Yeah, yeah, that's what I said.
No, it's already there.
Now, why would you not go with a less strong potency?
Okay, or you can just...
Okay, first you choose your potency, and then you choose the repetition, and you choose the administration of the way you're going to administer the remedy. You can have the patient smell the remedy, you can put it in water and so on. This is a patient I've been treating for about 9 months, and she, the potency she is, She's taking now. She has to dilute that way, because otherwise she will have too much aggravation, and she cannot go down the potency because she just took the previous potency.
Right.
Previous lower potency.
So she had diluted it through 4 glasses, and that was too strong still, and then 8, and so she's worked her way up to 16, and that works just right.
Yeah, and I have some patients that they do it even more than 16. They do it until the point they don't get an aggravation.
Okay, thank you.
They do it 20 times. Because I have some very sick people, and sometimes they're very, very hypersensitive. So you have to find a way that they do not
see what?
To a point where it's uncomfortable.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, another question?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Seaman. Thank you for being with us. Just in relating to what this lady was just saying, how important is having an aggravation or not having an aggravation?
Well, usually when you prescribe or infect remedy, you will have an aggravation. It's unusual not to have an aggravation. However, you don't want the patient to suffer. So if you're not careful or you're not experienced, the patient will experience an aggravation of the symptom, and you don't want to do that. So there will be an aggravation if the remedy has a high degree of similarity, and the idea is to minimize that aggravation. So that's why I'd say you have to individualize the potency, the repetition, and the way you administer the remedy.
Andre, I know there's some practitioners out there who like to see aggravations because then they feel that they're on the right track. What do you think about that?
Well, you will have an aggravation whether you like or not. There will be an aggravation if there's a remedy with a high degree of similarity. It will be. But
right.
The thing is, you don't want the patient to suffer,
sure.
So you want to minimize it.
Sure. Fair enough. Another question?
Again, Dr. Sane, with the aggravation, so what you are saying as well is you will have an aggravation, but in essence, you want it to not last, as well as if you don't have an aggravation, is it possibly that it's the wrong remedy?
If a patient is sensitive, you could have an aggravation, and it is the wrong remedy. But if it's the right remedy, that's more rare. If it's the right remedy, you will have an aggravation in the great, great majority of patients. I would say about 90% plus you will have an aggravation. However, sometimes patients say they've never got an aggravation from the remedy. But when you investigate, you find out, oh, they had a lot of dreams or restless sleep. So for them, they didn't identify as an aggravation. But eventually, they say, every time you give me that remedy, the first evening after I take the remedy, I get a lot of dreams in my sleep, and I'm restless. So eventually I are able to identify what is that initial aggravation. But if you have the wrong remedy, unless the patient is sensitive, usually there's nothing that happens. But if you have the right remedy, here we're talking about people that have chronic problem, not acute problem, you will have an aggravation as a general rule.
I think we have time for one final question.
Yes, hi, Dr. Sane. Is there a repertory that you trust, that you feel that is imperative to use?
It doesn't matter which repertory you use. It's not the repertory is important, is the Mathematica. The repertory is just to tell you which remedy to study. So, of course, you want to use a repertory that is reliable, that is as reliable entry, and is as complete as possible. But it's not that important because at the end, you have to go look at the Mathematica. So the most important thing is you have to use reliable Mathematica to be able to individualize properly. So try to use the repertory as complete as possible. Try to know which author are reliable and which are not reliable. Don't pay attention to their references. And then when you need to differentiate the different remedy for your specific case, then use reliable Mathematicas.
Andre, can you give us a quick list of those Mathematicas that you feel are reliable?
Well, the reliable Mathematica, of course, is Hahnemann is the very top best.
Mm.
And second to that would be Allen and Herring. Allen
Henry Clay
that,
Allen? Is that
symptom. And then after that would be compilation of the remedy that were developed after Herring and Allen, so you'll find some in different Mathematica, but essentially the essential Mathematica is the core is Hahnemann Mathematica, supplement by Allen and Herring.
And Allen, it's H.C. Allen, is that correct?
No, that's Timothy Phil Allen.
T.F. Allen, the Encyclopedia of Pure Materia Medica.
Right.
Okay. All right, well, fantastic. Let me go ahead and unmute the lines and let everybody personally thank you. I want to thank you, Andre, for taking the time out and joining us. This was a wonderful call, very, very informative, and I know I got a lot out of it myself. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Can everybody give Andre a big thank you?
Thank you.
Thank you, Andre.
Very nice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.